Welcome to the Cricket Matters podcast, the podcast for cricketers, by cricketers who want to train smarter and perform better. If you want to score more runs, take more wickets and field like a pro, this is the show for you. We release a new episode every Tuesday, and if you haven't got your copy of the High Performance Handbook for Cricketers yet, you can get your free copy at cricketmatters.com. Now, back to the crease.
Hi there and welcome to the Cricket Matters podcast. I'm James Breeze, co-host of the Cricket Matters podcast, and flying solo today as Josh Kennedy is too busy crying about Everton Football Club. Now, if you're new to the show, it's great to have you here. And if you're a regular, welcome back. It's great to have you here too. A couple of shout outs before we dive in today, and that's to all the boys of the XL Club Wales and all the boys of Club Cymraeg Cricket Caerdydd, who I play cricket for reviewing the podcast and sending us up the charts. Thanks, boys. It's much appreciated. So shout out to all of you. Now, today we've got a fantastic guest who I know as Kenny, but who's got a fair amount of experience on the cricketing circuit and has one or two stories to tell about it too. Now, he's a former professional cricketer, having played for Glamorgan and provincial cricket out in South Africa. And when his professional cricket career was drawing to a close and he had to get a real job, he had to venture into the world of pharmaceuticals, otherwise known as drug dealing in my terms, and he's now part of the Day Lewis Management Board. Now, more recently, he's been making a big cricketing comeback with Cardiff Cricket Club, which is where I met him for the first time, and now the last couple of years with the Wales Over 50s team, a big shout out to those guys, who are heading out to South Africa very soon for the Over 50s World Cup. It is with great pleasure I'd like to welcome to the show Michael Cann. Canny, how the devil are you?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks, James, and thanks for that lovely introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, I had to be as professional as possible, mate. Having known you like in a non-professional terms for quite some time, I thought I'd try and be as professional as I possibly could. But so, as we say to everyone when they first join the show, tell us a little bit about yourself in less than 30 seconds, because I know you like to chat, and tell us why cricket matters to you.
Well, I mean, I can cast my mind back sort of 42 years when I first started playing for Cardiff. It had a massive influence and impact on my life. You know, it allowed me to flourish as a young lad, you know, build my self-esteem and confidence as I grew through and went through the Cardiff ranks, eventually to becoming a professional cricketer. When that came to the end, I'd learned so much and had through that had understood that things like universities existed, so I managed to get educated. So it meant that I was set up both as a guy and as a professional to have a second career after cricket. And of course, then you come to the other end of your life, your career rather, and it's reversed again. It's gone back from my professional career more back into my cricket.
Brilliant. So tell me a little bit about that. Tell me how it's felt like having, because obviously you had a very experienced and distinguished career in the pharmaceutical industry and like done a lot. I haven't even done it justice on the podcast sharing about that. But tell us what it's like now going back into cricket after a bit of a gap away and what it was like for you.
Yeah, so I played, I stopped playing professionally in 94 and then had a couple of years off when I came back to the UK from South Africa and started to play cricket again, a little bit of club cricket. And I sort of stopped in the early 2000s. As my career developed, you know, you do have to make those balance and trade-offs. And then as I hit my early 50s, I was just getting worn out, to be honest. I was a burnt-out classical pharmaceutical or corporate executive and thinking, actually, this is not what life's all about. And around the same time, you know, the pandemic came along in, three or so years ago. And I was asked, do I want to get back involved with Cardiff? And they asked me to be their president because I played there for many years, captained the team and played professionally. And I was delighted. So I accepted that. And then I thought, well, why aren't I playing? You know, and in reality, I was heavily overweight, pretty unfit, and the thought of playing wasn't great. But then after the first lockdown, the thought of it became really attractive. So I thought, well, no, I am going to give it a go. Why not?
It's interesting you say that, because that's how we met, is it through Cardiff Cricket Club. And it's one of the most, the best inspirations was you starting at the same time again as me. Because, you know, in similar fashion, life career took me away from cricket. And I can't tell you why. It just life got in the way. And it's 10 years my life went by, and then suddenly I moved back to Cardiff. And it was that moment where reconnecting with the Cardiff Cricket Club boys, who said, "Hey, Breezy, there's a game tomorrow night. I see you're back. Come and join in." And that sent this snowball effect coming back into it. But it was the enthusiasm I had like a kid again. I don't know how else to describe it. But it was like, I stopped playing, but I've gone back and I've got this enthusiasm to play again. And I think it was like your infectious enthusiasm as well that set it off. And when we started the Breakfast Club up in Cardiff CC, where it was more, yes, it was involved with the cricket, but it was more the social aspect where we're turning up again. Like you had your professional mindset on. I wanted to train that way. Like, we went to have a coffee, then we had a net, then we started playing the game. And suddenly we attracted everyone to it. It was like this infectious thing that goes, "Oh my God, I've got the bug for cricket again," which is kind of why we've ended up with Cricket Matters and the podcast now, is because I've really got that bug to helping people and showing people. But yeah, it is interesting, like, you know, that walk and that change and that development of both you through that first season back. And it was my first season back as well by the end of the season. And then it was interesting to see the carryover through now to where you're at the moment too.
And it is, James. And actually what you get out of playing cricket and actually being fit and playing cricket, as even more so, is that sense of belonging. You know, mm-hmm. So even if you've been away from the game for 5 or 10 or 20 years, as I was, and I did play a little bit in between, by the way, for my local village. But you're always welcome back, and that's what really was lovely, you know. And so in Wales over 50s, we call it our second innings.
And I'd say I'm going to get into the Wales over 50s a bit later on, because I think I love it. I think it's absolutely fantastic seeing the over 50s, over 60s and over 70s and knowing old coaches, friends like yourself, Goose, and all shout out to all the boys in the over 50s, actually. I think it's fantastic because it is your second innings. And it's up for a lot of people. They think that's their career or that's their game over. But what we're trying to do is show them that it's not. If you make some changes to your lifestyle habits,
You've got your best cricket ahead of you.
Exactly. And the most fun sociable aspect as well, because that's the thing about cricket. Now, obviously, this podcast is about training smarter and performing better. So this is why you're kind of a perfect example here to talk about the early days of like what it was like to be a professional cricketer and seeing the difference to what you're doing now. And just so everyone can learn from that aspect as well. So just let's roll back to your days as an early Glamorgan professional. Tell us a little bit about what it was like, and tell us about what the training looked like back then for you, both in terms of skill practice and in terms of fitness.
So you would practice. So as a professional cricketer, you're basically employed between the 1st of April and around about the 20th of September in those days. That's changed considerably now, but I'm talking here about my first contract was in 1984. Now, I wasn't brought up as somebody who trained or did anything beyond practice my skills, batting, bowling, fielding. So everything we did in those days was slightly less tailored, but actually more geared towards skills. And classically, training would involve a big long run, a load of rugby-type training, and that's prevalent in Wales. So even at Glamorgan's pre-season training, when I joined the staff there, our physio would take the training for pre-season. You know, it'd be the first 3 weeks in April, maybe 3.5, depending on when the fixtures started. And that would essentially be run by a guy called Tudor Jones, who actually at that time was the physio to the Welsh rugby team. So he was as qualified as anybody. But basically, you were doing circuit squats, runs, sprints, shuttles around rugby fields and cricket fields. And actually, I think there is something around the sort of background sporting culture that drove those type of training regimes. Typically, we would turn up for pre-season, kill ourselves for a month, and become very fit doing it. And then we would tail off then till the end of the season. Typically, we'd put on weight, slow down. And then people like myself would go abroad to spend the winter abroad playing cricket. And we would train, but nothing like to the level of what was needed for the sport. So, you know, that in a microcosm was how the professional sport worked. There were players individually, and Tony Cotty is an example of somebody who just trained compulsively. But he was an ex-professional footballer as well. So they were actually few and far between. Typically, a lot of cricketers were concerned about putting on weight because you're literally away for 100 days during the cricket season in hotels. So, you know, it would be probably a 3 or 4 mile run a couple of times a week to, you know, to keep the stamina up, the weight down, and then skills training. We did reasonable warm-ups before the start of the game, but essentially they weren't based on mobility or any sort of things you and I talk about now, James.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So go back to those early days. You obviously played with some famous people back in there. We'll focus on the Glamorgan side of things first. Who would you say were the people you looked up to the most in terms of both practice and their fitness regime?
Yeah, it's quite funny, actually, because we were a reasonably fit side, I think. We weren't terribly unfit. I mean, you've got to take someone like Hugh Morris. Hugh Morris, outstanding, brilliant cricketer. Also played very high standard of rugby. Played for Aberavon. He played for, you know, his teacher training college, as it was in those days. Played very high standard of rugby. So was innately fit. You know, and his fitness, I mean, he was a great runner, did a lot, less weight training in those days, less gym training. There were other people at the other end of the spectrum, people like Steve Barwick, who really couldn't run more than a couple of miles, but could pull 40 overs in a day. So his training regimen was to go in the nets and bowl and bowl and bowl. And he did that extremely successfully. So it's a more of a spectrum of players. Other players you had to look up to and have huge respect for were those players who really maximised their careers. People like Steve James, who also went on to play for England, who was at university with me as well. You know, you wouldn't necessarily write him a script of being a Josh Butler, but actually what he did is he used fitness and training to improve his stamina, his resilience, and his exceptional approach to batting to the crease. I would say a lot of the players individually adapted to their game. And then we used to sign the odd veteran, and, you know, remarkably, someone like Viv Richards, who joined us in 1990. When he turned up, I think he must have been late 30s or even 40 at that point. You know, we noticed what a physical specimen he was. And we know he didn't do it publicly. We know he trained quite hard. He looked after his body and he practiced very hard his skills. And that's sometimes hidden from the greats we hear about. And you have to look at those people at that age in their life to be so physically, supremely fit to still compete with people 20 years younger than them is much more than the talent they had. So I would sort of articulate those sort of people. I'd say the one person who probably, and I've mentioned him already, is Tony Cotty. Tony Cotty scored 19,000 first-class runs for Glamorgan and Sussex. He's one of the few people who have won a county championship with more than one county. I think he's pretty much the only Welshman who's ever done that. He's an absolute credit of a bloke, and he is somebody who probably kept himself fitter than any other cricketer I've ever known.
It's interesting to talk about that. Let's just take Tony Cotty and Viv Richards. It's surprising their success, and it ties back into their fitness. Because I'm trying to get across to a lot of young cricketers at the moment who I come across at Cardiff, is that cricket's evolving extremely quickly. And the skill set of some of the young kids today are fantastic. They're all reverse sweeping. They're all doing ramp shots. You know, things that come second nature to them. They don't need to work hard on it. But what I keep saying to them is that if everyone's got that basic skill set, the thing that's going to make you stand out more than anything is your physical fitness, because that's going to make you a more athletic fielder. But it also carries on to making better decisions on the field, i.e. when are you going to leave the ball? When are you going to play the ball?
James, I couldn't agree more, actually. In the game, the way it's played today, the shorter formats, the T20s, the club games are 45 overs. The intensity levels are much greater than when I played. There's no doubt about it, but they're for shorter periods of time. And that means your fitness has to be very different. In fact, I can remember when I played, I don't know if you look at my sort of first class average, had I been 20, 30% more fit or had a different relationship with my fitness centers like I do now, I've no doubt that my career would either have been longer or certainly had more depth to it during the time that I played. I've no doubt at all. I was never inspired to get fit. Not as inspired as I've been in the last 18 months, 2 years.
It's interesting you say that. So here goes, two questions for you now. First one is, what if you had to go, you could go back in time machine back to the 1980s at the start of your career with Glamorgan, what would you do differently? And I mean that in the nicest possible way, because there's lots of things you probably wouldn't change. But in terms of your training and your fitness regime, what would you do now that you now know differently?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And where'd you start? I mean, hindsight and acquired knowledge is a wonderful thing. You know, when you look back, what would I do differently? I certainly would have done much more mobility training. There is no doubt about that. That's, you know, but we didn't even know what that meant back in the 80s. You know, it wasn't a consideration. In terms of stamina, I was reasonable. But, you know, the thing that tails off, particularly in cricket, when you're tired, is concentration. Mm-hmm. So I think I would have done more stamina work as well. I wasn't slow. I innately wasn't a super fast Olympic sprinter. But I was reasonable at performing in beep tests and those sort of things, which were the vogue back then, particularly in the early 90s. So I think I was probably right in that regard. As you touched on earlier, the first thing that goes when you are not fit enough and you're playing cricket is your concentration. And when your concentration goes, your judgment goes. So I reckon, had I done those things, I would have batted longer and therefore got bigger scores, even though actually my skill level was probably maxed out, to be fair.
That's interesting.
The second part of it is my bowling developed later in my career, which gave me two strengths to my bowl. I'd always bowled a bit, and I'd bowled for Welsh schools, but as a professional, I only started to bowl a bit later in my early 20s. And to bat and bowl in professional sport, you do need to have an elevated fitness. And I don't believe my fitness was ever elevated enough to do both.
Interesting. Let's go back to a specific moment in your career. Think about something where you were batting. Let's stick with the batting, where you think that your stamina or lack of fitness may have cost you those extra runs. Was there an important moment or an important game or an important part of your career that maybe something didn't happen? Is there like a specific innings that you can remember?
Yeah, I can. I mean, it's my only 100 for Glamorgan. We were chasing a fourth day target against Somerset in quite a reasonably high scoring game from memory. I can't quite remember the totals off the top of my head, but I'd got my maiden first-class 100 at Cardiff, at Sapphire Garden. and I still remember the old pavilion there, you know, which is a lovely old site built in the 60s. And some of the Cardiff boys up there and the members. Lovely time. And we were chasing this total. I think we needed about 100 off 20 overs. And I was batting with Ravi Shastri and going well and all the rest of it. And a couple of things happened when you're not fully in control of your fitness. You do start getting a bit tired. And I got through the 100, and I think I was 107 or 109 not out. And I played a couple of good shots to take me past through the 100. You know, something I'll never forget. And this feeling of elation. And after the elation becomes the drop in energy, doesn't it? You know, phew, I'm there.
Yep.
And then you need somebody to take that on to kick on. We should have won a match, actually. And it's the guy who's control. I mean, even though it's my first 100 for Glamorgan, or my only first class 100 for Glamorgan, I should have gone on and won the game because I had one of the best players in the world at the other end with me. All right. And Vic Marks, who you may be familiar with, some of the listeners may be familiar with, ended up chipping away and actually bowling and getting a few of us caught in the boundary. He didn't get me out. Neil Mallinder got me out. But very much, had I been 20% fitter, I think I would have taken control of that situation very differently and allowed myself a sustainable next hour in the match to bring that game home. And in fact, I played a lot of cricket in South Africa against Kepler Wessels, and he was one of the fittest men I have ever seen on a cricket field. In fact, he did boxing training. And I learned very much later around why he trained as hard as he did. And he talked exactly around those situations. And he was an immensely fit man and with good talent, but a limited skill level. And so it allowed him to elevate, to score those big scores. And his record is phenomenal.
It's fascinating listening to this, because like I never knew you played with Ravi Shastri. In all the years, I've been, you know, knowing you now and stuff like that. So you obviously played with a lot of, you know, very household names in terms of cricket. So let's go back into South Africa. Like, tell us about that transition from Glamorgan into the provincial side of things in South Africa, and some of the players you saw coming up through the ranks and some of the people you played with, and talk about their skill set and their development. How did it differ to that?
It's a good question, because different culture, right? Very different culture. Very much concentrated on early developers, not late developers. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough, because there was a guy called Corrie van Sail, who was Glamorgan's professional with Ravi Shastri at that time. That's before the Viv Richards days. And Corrie came over, and he had owned a bowling for South Africa in what were the rebel tests in those days against Australia rebels and West Indies rebels. So he's at the peak of his powers, if you like, at that point. And he'd come from a very small province, which was Orange Free State. Now, the people who know rugby will know Orange Free State very, very well. Very Afrikaans dominated back in those days, of before multiracial sport out there. Very much strong nationalist identity, Afrikaans speaking part of the world. Oranje Vrystaat, or Orange Free State, depending on perspective. All right. So he had invited me to become a coach at Free State University. And he was the head coach, and I'd be his assistant, and I'd look after the more junior players and all that. And I was 21, all right? So off I went. I was 22, perhaps. Off I went on the plane. And I'd mentioned to you a little bit earlier that my bowling had been a useful addition, you know, in the Glamorgan second team. I bowled a bit, and, in the over-25s and the one-day games, I'd be the fourth, fifth bowler. And for Cardiff, maybe a bit more before I'd become a real bowling contributor. Anyway, I was an off-spinner, and they didn't have an off-spinner in the state side. So in the university team, at the age of 17, was Hansie Cronier. His brother Franz was about 22. We had a guy called Nicky Bouyer, who was a 16-year-old who went on to play for South Africa. A guy called Dion Yordan, who played South Africa seconds and provincial cricket in Northern Transvaal. And those sort of things. We're a real massive cohort of players. And Alan Donald was a part of the Free State squad at that time as well, very young, and all a bit tear away. And a guy called Rudy Steyn as well, who also went on to play one day cricket for South Africa. All of that remarkable cohort of young players. And it was an unestablished province. And interestingly, this is being taped before the England One Day International against South Africa tomorrow. We'll come on to it, but they're playing in Kimberley tomorrow, okay? Those two provinces, Free State and Kimberley, were the two inland provinces. But the point about Free State is they had this remarkable depth of talent. Ashley Metcalf, Yorkshire and England, was their overseas pro, and Peter Moores was the overseas pro, so he was keeping wicket there. We became good friends. What happened to me was, as a 21-year-old, 22-year-old pro, was I got invited along to come and bowl at the provincial nets because they didn't have an off-spinner. And actually, South Africa never really at that time, in the isolated years, produced many spinners at all. And they weren't very good at playing spin. They played it from the crease and didn't sweep. Okay, so, you know, they ended up just sort of... So they made me look very good. So I got invited along to participate in these nets, and that's why I sort of got known at provincial level at the first stop in South Africa. So I'd toil away, and it was a semi-professional sport in those days, James, in that people would work, or they were students, or in the defence force, for example, and the nets would be, say, practice sessions would be sort of 5 to 7, 3 nights a week, and maybe 6 to 8 in the morning, 1 morning a week. All right, because the climate would allow you to do that.
Yeah.
And I would come along and I would bowl. And then when it didn't clash with my coaching responsibilities at the university, I'd attend those sessions. So I sort of broadly involved with the Free State squad. And it was great fun. It was just good to be a part of that. And they're pretty nasty to me, all right, because as the Welshman who'd landed, and so I'd bowl away for an hour and a half. And there's nothing better to develop my bowling than to bowl in that environment. And, you know, bowling to Hearty Cronier and, you know, to Louis Wilkinson and Rudolf Steyn and these guys, Ashley Metcalf, toiling away there. And then towards the end of the session, the coach, which is an amazing guy called Johan Falstead, who was a school teacher, actually, at Great College, but had a remarkable ability to create provincial and international cricketers. He'd say, come on in, Canny, you can have a bat. All right. Stick them on, son. So I'd go off I'd go. And it started to get dark, you know, it started to get dark because twilight in Southern Africa happens in about 10 or 15 minutes. So, you know, it's not like in Britain where it takes an hour at dusk and all these sort of things. So I'd be going to bat just before it gets dark, all right? And I used to, it was terrible because then he'd go to Alan Donald and Corrie and a guy called Johan van Heerden and say, and he'd give him a new ball. Right, so it's getting dark and he's throwing an Alan Donald new ball saying, all right, boys, have a little run in with the new ball and you can bring that one tomorrow for practice, all right? So I'd be jumping around, letting it go, and I'd just bowl for an hour and a half. But, you know, the culture was very different. These guys would do immense fitness. They went to the gym. Aerobics was the vogue of the day, so there was aerobics classes they all did. Around.
I've got visions of Alan Donald in Lycra now, Jane Fonda style.
No, that's the point. They'd have their training shorts, off they would go, they would do all that sort of stuff, and they would train. But what they didn't have is six-hour net sessions, which was what the approach was, as I said, in England, or in Britain. We would have skill-based net session training. Their approach to fitness was totally different. Totally different. And actually,
yeah, it's interesting because, like, just culturally, and when you're traveling around the world and seeing people, I always say South Africans and Kiwis are naturally more physically built than us Northern Europeans, I think is the best way to put it.
I mean, their diet is very different. I mean, in Southern Africa, very much a protein based diet, meat based diet. It's in abundance because the agricultural base is different. You know, they would very much eat fresh vegetables, unprocessed food, no doubt about it.
Okay. Secret of
Their alcohol intake was probably no different, interestingly, to ours. But their diet was much better. And that relationship between their sporting performance and fitness was ingrained, culturally ingrained, and is expected that's what you would do. Whereas I felt... when I was a professional cricketer, those two were decoupled. You trained or you practiced.
Yeah. No, it's right. It is culturally on so many different levels. And it's, you know, particularly from my experience of being out in New Zealand, not playing cricket, just me sports and seeing all the rugby development side of things out there. It is, they're just naturally more athletic and it's more, like farmer type. It's similar to Wales. Parts where I go from in mid Wales, where I'm from, I'm from a farming community. And all my cousins and friends are farmers who've never been to the gym in the world, but you give them a couple of hay bales to shove onto the thing, they'll go all day. And they're so strong. And it's that type of fitness. I mean, it's that all-day strength training and fitness. It's practical, not gym-based strength training that I'm talking about. It's just natural strong and fit.
You hit the nail on the head. I couldn't agree more. And that becomes ingrained in your culture. And then it becomes passed on and passed sideways to people, you know.
It is, and even today, you look at professional South African rugby side. Like most of them look like beasts. They're absolute monsters and units, and they're not just big and strong. They're fit, they're lean, athletic to go alongside it. Now, I love, like, on so many different levels. The name again, just the names. I grew up watching play test cricket and stuff like that. And I still love watching Alan Donald in the nets. And, you know, to me, he's one of those cricketers that was fascinating to watch, exciting to watch. He was quick as any. His battle with Atherton is famous, and it will be famous for forever in time. But he also reminds me of an athlete who had longevity to his career. What did you say about his fitness and ingrained in his practice in the nets, but what was something that you maybe saw him do behind the scenes that maybe only you saw because you would have been there behind the scenes with him? What's something that you sticks out in your mind, not in terms of skill-based stuff, but like what was he doing different to other people that were around him?
Yeah, I can't say specifically because I wouldn't say I was particularly watching at the time, but I do know that he had a very good relationship with his body. He definitely looked after himself. I was definitely in social situations with him at people's houses where, you know, he would eat discreetly. And you could definitely see he had a good relationship with his body. He wouldn't be last to leave a social occasion. He would be good to leave. I think he slept well, right? Mm-hmm. I think he really did treat that side of his game importantly. I think he stretched very well. I think that was important to him. But I'd never saw him training specifically to battle or to bowl, for that matter. But he treated his body really, really well, really well. He was kind to himself, I've no doubt about that. And he was an explosive bowler, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was not one to bowl you 30 overs a day, although he could. But he was explosive, and he could switch on and switch off. So whatever he did, he definitely looked after himself supremely well.
Brilliant. And what was it like facing him for the first time? Because I always remember Kevin Peterson's quote on TV saying how when he faced Alan Donald for the first time, he was too busy watching Alan Donald going, this is Alan Donald bowling at me. And he didn't watch the ball. It bowled his middle stump, apparently. So what was it like for you for that moment?
Well, he was quick. I think first time I played against him actually was at Swansea for Glamorgan Seconds when he was, he had come over to Warwickshire at a very young age, and we played a game, and he was very fast. In those days, he didn't have his hand behind the ball as well as he did later in his career when he had immense control. And so he tended to angle the ball into the batsman or across me because I'm a left-hander. So in some ways, it was a little easier for me because it went across. You either missed it by a mile or if it was too quick, it didn't hit you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I found him okay. The one thing about Donald is, as fast as he was, he showed you the ball. The people I used to find much harder to bat against were people who didn't show you the ball so much. People like Courtney Walsh, where it came from an unusual position in the action. Or even someone like Tony Pigott at Sussex, who did something at the crease and you would lose it for that split second. Or you can imagine, and I never played against him, but somebody like Jeff Thompson, who is a slinger from behind the back. You lose the ball, and then it's harder to pick it up. I played against Australia, and Merv Hughes I found quite awkward, because, again, he didn't show you the ball in his run-up as much. He showed you the ball in his run-up, and then, but then in his action, the ball would disappear and then come back at you. And so, you know, I find those bowlers more difficult to face than the out-and-out pace, because I used to see the ball reasonably well off the hand.
Interesting. But I've got to tell you this. This is great. This is what I love about cricket, all these little stories that go off and offshoots out of it. My mate Simon Williams, shout out to Simon from Aberystwyth. He has bought a house in Dinas Parish recently, and in his back garden, in his shed, he's made it the cricketing bar. So he's got all these old school bats from the 80s and 90s, right? And he's got this memorabilia. And one of my favourite ones, he's got a photo framed on the wall with all these different photos, like from Alan Donald to like Shane Warne to everyone here. But my favourite one is the one of Merv Hughes stretching down at Bay 13 at the MCG, doing his little waves, which is absolutely brilliant. So shout out to Simon for this, because like it was just brilliant. Like it was a great little tour. And I'll have to do a video series, I think, just behind the scenes of the memorabilia he has in there. Well, that's great. Well, let's segue in briefly into the latter years of the career, but going into more finding a real job, as you called it. How did you find that come down from playing cricket as a job, as a profession, to going into the corporate world? And what do you think, what were the detrimental effects it may have had on your lifestyle and body? And what is it something that you wish you could have changed about that? Because there's a lot of club cricketers out there, on professional cricketers as well, actually, who's a similar position to you, but are in this position now. What's something, or going into it, you know, what's the advice you can share with them? What are the things you learned during that part of your career?
Oh, James, hindsight is an easy gift to spread around the world. And, you know, I don't want to sound patronising, but my experience is we're interested in that. First of all, my Glamorgan career ended in 1991. My full professional career ended in 1994. Because I continued to play in South Africa after Glamorgan, and in fact was more successful after I'd left Glamorgan. A number of things happened. The other thing which is really strange for this podcast, is that we smoked cigarettes. Okay, so the major sponsors, both in UK professional sport and in South African professional sport, were Benson and Hedges, mm-hmm. okay, and Imperial Tobacco. So yeah. I smoked, right? Now, I reckon you're probably burning 5,000 calories a day playing professional cricket. You're fielding all day, you're running around, you're batting, you're bowling, whatever. And you have an appetite that goes with that, okay? And the moment you stop playing professional sport, the calorific intake reduces, but, you know, your eating habits don't change, do they? So you start, the first thing that happens, you put on weight, okay? It almost immediately, not a huge amount, but that really, as you describe, the sort of trimmed live body, not the muscle-bound body, you start to develop a layer of fat that goes with that. And, you know, hindsight's a lovely gift. You know, in hindsight, you could modify your diet accordingly. And then I stopped smoking in 1997, 3 years after I stopped being a professional cricketer, you know. A couple of reasons. One, it's a terrible, terrible habit. It's deleterious to your health. That's a no-brainer. But it became very, very expensive. and that was the second weight gain time of my life. Okay, and they weren't related to my corporate career. They were related to those changes in circumstances. So the first thing I'd be saying to people who stop playing cricket or sport at any level where you've got a change in energy levels is be very careful about your calorific intake, because you can put on weight very rapidly. And actually, that causes a bit of a negative downward spiral in how you feel about yourself and the sport you used to play. Okay. I'd say the second thing that comes out of not being a professional is this, you lose a sense of belonging to the changing room. And that's quite hard for people to disengage on. And in fact, it's harder for cricket than any other sport, I think, because we spend so much time together. It's like being extracted from a family. As tough as that family can be on you, because you're competing for a place, either in the first team or in the second team, trying to get into the first team. So that feeling of what is essentially an emotionally support network can also take you into a more difficult place when it's whipped away. And it's much tougher in cricket. And in fact, cricket ex-professionals through the Professional Cricket Association, of which I'm a member, has had to put in place quite a lot of support mechanisms for people leaving the sport. That hasn't really cut across to what to do fitness-wise, but certainly from a mental health perspective, there's a lot of initiatives around that. But back to me personally, my career at Glamorgan finished in 91. I still had 2 or 3 years still playing first-class cricket in South Africa provincial cricket for Griqualand West, which is my province there, now known as Northern Cape, if you go and Google it. Mm-hmm. And I came back in 1994 to start a job. And I started in the sales and marketing route. And the first thing about that is at the time when my exercise levels or my fitness levels or my energy levels, calorific burn was reducing, you start to spend more time in a car or at an office desk, or in social environments where you may be with clients or at conferences or whatever, all of which are social engagement occasions, all right? And actually that switch from one position to another, and even if you're a club cricketer, you know, hanging their boots up at 30 or 32, you'll notice a big difference, you know, because you have to adapt something else in your lifestyle, particularly your eating habits, I think, to adjust to that. And I put a lot of weight on through the 90s.
But it's interesting because you see that as well. I remember back in, again, when I was a young pup playing club cricket, you see all the guys in their mid-30s and 40s. I always remember them saying to me, just you wait to get to this age, you won't want to play more than one game a weekend either. And I went, no, that's not going to happen to me. I'm not going to make sure that doesn't happen to me. The older I've got, I've understood why they said it. But my goal is to try and recover fast enough so I can do those second games and stuff as well.
Yeah, and James, also, that's something I've learned through, you know, through the program you've got me on, immensely so. You can do more if you work on the things that you've prescribed.
Yeah, and that's what we're trying. That's the whole purpose of Cricket Matters, is to educate cricketers all over the world. Like, particularly, I wish I knew what I knew now, when I was 13, 14, 15, growing up on my little farm in Wales, where I was bowling against the wall. The nearest club to me was Aberystwyth, which was an hour drive for my mum to drive me there. There was no cricket around by me. Or 45-minute drive to Llanidloes, where I then started playing for a little bit then. I wish I could have the YouTube, or if someone's saying, what can I do? Because I was so motivated at home to try and play cricket. But all I had was my own knowledge and a couple of books that were lying around too. And it's sharing the information that you have, your experience, with the future generations coming up. And also the coaches who are current at the moment to help pass on that knowledge is what we're desperately trying to do. And to touch on nutrition, it's interesting seeing, again, a lot of club cricketers, you know, finish playing cricket, they put on weight. But also at the professional level, you start to see it. There's a couple of guys who are coming to the end of their career from England. And he's starting to see that weight gain starting to happen. Not to mean they're bad people or anything at all, but you can just see these things starting to happen. And and they're probably not aware that it is happening because it's not something they're thinking about. But I wish you could just have those conversations and with them. And then touching on the nutrition side of things for, again, professional players, some of the England boys, you see it. They're on the road pretty much 300 days of the year now. They're playing cricket all the time. So the lifestyle habits you talk about, the corporate life, traveling, social events, it changes. And they have to be even more careful because, again, you see the extra bit of body fat they're carrying now, the slightly redness in the cheeks, puffiness in the cheeks. It's ways and mechanisms to help do it because that will have a detrimental impact to their sport.
Yeah, and I would add one other thing to that. As your first innings starts to wane, and I'll call it the first innings because that's how I like to describe it. Yeah. As that starts to wane, because it's becoming tougher, because there's a bit of weight gain, because you may be feeling a slowdown, your confidence takes a knock. Your relationship with the game changes. And the game becomes a little bit painful for you, all right? Because you know you're not the person you were. The self-esteem starts to reduce. And that creates an even more negative cycle. And then what happens is most people leave the game in their early 30s, which is what happened to me.
Yeah, and it's really sad because this, as we now know, as we're going to segue into it now, there's your second innings potential now to happen and take on, to take that career further, extend it further, because cricket's not just about obviously it's about the winning performance and like playing in front of crowds, we all understand that. But also it's the social aspect, the camaraderie, and the experiences you have to share with people and go through. And this is why you're off to South Africa in less than a month's time for the over 50s World Cup. So let's talk into this. Tell us about the catalyst that helped got you back into playing cricket again. What was obviously Cardiff being president of the CC, but what was the thing that made you go, no, I want to start playing again? What was the thing?
Well, it's always been in me, all right? You know, I've always hankered for it. I started to think about coming home a little bit. I'd lived in England for the best part of 25, 26 years. And that fateful phone call from David Ricketts that says, do you fancy a game? Many people in South Wales have had that over the years. And I said, well, why not? Why wouldn't I? I'm president. It'd be nice to come back and play. And so he'd made a space for me in the side. And I absolutely loved the day out to connect with some old friends like Ian Bridgman, David Herbert, Matt Phillips, David himself. Jonathan Good, who's a lot younger than me, but played with his dad. So those connections felt really real for me. And I just thought, well, I want a bit more of it. As it happens, we were up at Abercynon, up the Cynon Valley, and I was out second ball, half volley by a guy called Matthew Taylor. He's a slow medium bowler who I hit to sort of cover and got caught. But I thought this was fantastic. And it brought back such good memories. It's interesting what I said about the things that will make you leave the game, the things that are painful and the things you stop doing so well. You don't create the counterbalance at that point for the other side, the benefit side around the well-being, the camaraderie, the sense of being a part of a community and a club. Those things aren't strong enough to counterbalance the bad feelings you get when things aren't going so well. Or they weren't for me at that time. Mm-hmm. But when I did come back, that really was quite inspirational. And then Matt Phillips has been involved in the over 50 setup for a while. And he sort of said to me, well, you know, the following season, why not throw your hat in the ring? So I did. It was hard work. So I played in the Wales over 50 second team under the leadership of Paul Donovan, who was the captain, and batted seven, bowled a few overs, but not quite a huge comeback, but then slowly got into it. And that's where we started up the Breakfast Club and got things going. So, you know, your relationship with the game changes. It becomes a sense of joy, which I think is a lovely word to describe what people need in their lives to make it fulfilled and enjoyable and exciting. And it doesn't matter how old you are, you can have that sense of joy. And I started to develop that sense of joy. But my fitness was trailing, and I was 2 stone heavier than I am today. And I needed to do a bit more if I was going to make any contribution to the over 50s. So I started to eat a little better. And then in time, I joined the Cricket Matters program.
So let's talk about that in a little bit, but the differences you made. Because I saw you on that first season back, because we played together that first season for Cardiff, right? Playing together, and I saw you over the season. It was a great season. It was a hell of a laugh. You know, like, I always remember that season where I'd gone from batting almost number 11 to suddenly batting at number 3. And, like, you know, just seeing the life and times of David Ricketts, yeah, which is fantastic, absolutely. which is brilliant. It's absolutely, you know, won't change it for the world. It's been absolutely brilliant. That whole, like, the whole story with everyone, me, you, Goose, Bridgie, everyone, it's been absolutely fantastic. But there was, for me personally, watching you change on a cricket field, the way you played that first season to when you came into the second season of doing it. Like, it was a sense of pride. And I wasn't the one coaching you. Like, it was hats off to Josh, who's still crying about Everton Football Club today. Like, he, you know, he's the one that coached you following the system. But it was the differences I saw was your agility around the field. And, like, whereas a couple of balls may in the first season may have gone past you, through your legs, whatever it was here, you were suddenly swooping and taking runouts. Like, it was something that completely changed. And you saw it as well with your bowling action. You were able to put a lot more into your bowling. And you were, you know, you were probably the key bowler for the whole team, taking wickets, controlling an end and everything. And it gave you, I almost feel it gave you a responsibility, and you thrived off that responsibility of, like, pegging teams back or taking the wickets and stuff like that. So, but to me, that was huge. So what were the things that you think made the biggest difference from that first season to the second season? You're still the same cricketer and still with the same mindset performance. But what were the little things between those two seasons that you think that we helped you with? And also you took responsibility and did. You put the hard work in. We just nudged you in the right direction. What were the differences?
Yeah, it's really, really clear to me looking back. It's not so clear at the time when you're going through the program. Mm-hmm. But the first month, Josh set me up with what was basically mobility. The assessments were, you know, the 60 or the 80 assessments I did at the start of the program, when you're measuring your flexibility and other things, your ability to do various things, various exercises, various stretches, gave Josh the benchmark. And he sort of said very, very kindly, you know, you need to work on your mobility before we start stretching yourself, before we start stretching you physically. And I thought, well, that's great. I don't quite know what that means, but it essentially meant really working on shoulders, hips, and the ability to rotate the spine, all the things mm-hmm. we're talking about now to the over 50s Wales team were back. And I did that routinely 5 days a week for the first month. And suddenly, things like the little power walks just to get us going became quite enjoyable. You know, you're not walking off feeling my hips are aching, my knees are aching, my arms are hurting. You suddenly get a feeling that actually this is elating. So your relationship with the training changed completely. And that's the biggest impact that I had. And I never enjoyed training as a professional cricketer. It was a necessary chore to be able to do something, mm-hmm. to be something. This changed my relationship with the training itself, the most fundamental level. And I think that's the biggest takeaway that I could give to somebody from my experience with Cricket Matters, right? In that it changed my relationship with myself and the sport. It let me understand how much mobility and flexibility enables me to get enjoyment out of training. Because who wants to go and do a half an hour commando walk with squats and all the stuff in the middle of it if you can't move your hips? You just end up walking off feeling worse than when you started. And that is not something you look forward to. And that's a great lesson. And it takes me back to what we said earlier about, you know, we did a load of squats-based rugby training when I was a professional cricketer. I didn't enjoy a single second of it. It's like, oh, my God, here we go again. I'm really, you know, another snake around a rugby field. I don't want to do that. Yes, of course, you know you have to do it. So you do something to be something. This taught me to be something, to do something. Right?
And it's interesting you say that, because like the hips and the shoulders and stuff. And again, it's been great. I absolutely love the fact that you brought me into the Wales over 50 setup, because this gives me a lot more joy to see people thinking they haven't got a career, another second innings, and to see that they can do it. And the same similar stories, I see it. But what I find fascinating is that the old boys, you know, the masters athletes, they call them in the over 50s, they're having the same issues as some of the youngsters I see coming through at the moment. The same thing, shoulders and hips, they're really tight. Maybe just a little bit more wear and tear and a little bit more exacerbated in the areas, but the young kids are having it too. So it's this is where, like, we're trying as best I can to educate them and say, look, this mobility stuff isn't just boring. The whole purpose is to extend your longevity of your playing career, to keep the memories and experiences you have going for longer. Like, Kenny, I'd love to see you at the over 70s World Cup. Like, you know, it's those little things I'd love to see keep happening. But it's, yeah, you're right.
Well, it's funny you should say that, James, because my relationship with the game has changed and it's taken me to this second innings. You know, I can't wait for that opportunity to arise. You know, I don't want to live in the future. I like to live in the day.
Yeah.
But I think, once you take on board some of the key lessons from Cricket Matters and apply them to yourself in a flexible way, you know, not in a regimented mm-hmm. way, then I think your relationship with training changes. And you sort of see it very differently. Rather than a means to an end, it becomes a part of the whole being a cricketer again. And that is a totally different relationship with the sport that I had earlier. Not as though it's better or worse, it's just very different.
Yeah, it is. And that's what we're trying to get across to people. It's, again, the same. It's about having a healthy relationship with food, but having a healthy relationship with the fitness, so you can enjoy the sport that we love so much, that binds and connects us all together, right? And that's the thing. A lot of people associate, and this is because of mainstream media, it's because of the way, you know, it's like sex sells, like hardcore fitness sells. They think unless you have a beatdown that you haven't had a good workout. Well, that's not the case. You should be feeling and leaving a cricket session as if you feel revitalized and energized, not beat down, sore and sweaty. Like I always say, and I say this joke over and over again, I can give someone, if someone's to be sore and sweaty, I can shove them in the sauna, get a massive bamboo cane and start hitting them with a bamboo cane, and it'll have the same effect as me giving a beat down workout. It's not about that. And particularly cricketers, because the cricket as a sport is such a hard sport on the body. It is such a physically demanding sport because it covers endurance multiple days at a time, explosiveness repeatedly over and over again. Put your joints, arms, limbs in such awkward positions that you have to train for longevity in mind, I think, as opposed to that rugby mentality where you do have to build up and be able to take the hits to protect the body. Cricket's not like that. You're not being smashed from other people from different walks of life. You've got to preserve the joints because they're fragile things at the best of time. And that's what I'm seeing. I say, go back to the over 50s, seeing them over the last and spending time with them over the last few weeks, is that if I could give any club cricketer or any aging masters cricketer, right, a bit of advice now, look after your shoulders, look after your hips, get a good solid massage in and around those areas to loosen everything up, because that is what's going to extend your career, I think, the most over the long
term. Yeah.
So there
couldn't
you go.
Agree more.
So shout out to all the over 50s boys going to Africa, and we'll have to get you back on to talk about it when you come back. I'd love to hear about the stories about that. But let's talk about another, before we draw to a close, let's talk about another passion of yours, and that's talk about cricket in the Welsh Valleys, because that's something I took part on last year and thoroughly enjoyed it with the Walking in the Valleys programme. So to tell the world a little bit about that, what that means to you and the importance of it, I think, for cricket in Wales.
Definitely. So I come from Llanrymney, which is very much a working class estate in Cardiff. And there are some similarities between Llanrymney and Cardiff and some of the communities in the valleys. I'm also passionate about Welsh cricket in that, why aren't we producing a Ben Stokes in Wales? You know, there's no reason why it shouldn't happen. But actually, the cultural shift, cricket in the last 30 years has become more exclusive to people, right? It's expensive. We have clothing and we have two bats instead of sharing one. And these sort of things become a very expensive sport. And actually, it means that some communities are left behind. And as part of my career, I want to give something back to the game because I took so much from it in my early years and it gave me so much in my professional career, my non-cricketing career. Cricket set me up to do that, and I see cricket as a force for good. And I see something in those clubs that actually affects the whole community, because in general, they are clubs which are community clubs. And either rugby or a cricket club will sit at the heart of the community, both socially and from an activity perspective. And those clubs are good at it, really good at it, really good. But they're small. In nature, those communities tend to be quite small, and Cardiff is a big club with hundreds of members and all the rest of it. So I thought, wouldn't it be a good idea if a few of us just did some fundraising? And so it was Abercannon, I spoke to, and Pontypridd, where I developed some friendships, and my great affinity for Hopkinstown and latterly for Macken. So we got into a dialogue and sort of started to think, it'd be a good idea. So we thought we'd walk from Cardiff to Brecon up the Taff Trail, and two or three clubs said, we'll give it a go. I thought, well, we'll have a couple of us doing a walk. That'd be nice. We raised maybe 500 quid, 1,000 per club, and then we sort of started to gain its own momentum. So we thought, myself and Tinker Taylor over at Ponty, thought that, perhaps we can ask a few people to wish us luck and endorse us, And each club had its own Just Giving site, and we had a central fund as well. So if we raised any money centrally, we could split that the five ways. And it sort of picked up. And, I went back to some of my old friends in South Africa, like Anil Donald, and said, would you please do, a good luck video? And he did. I couldn't believe it. He was coaching Bangladesh at the time. We were touring Southern Africa. So we got these endorsements. Matthew Maynard's been a great, great supporter of all these sort of things. He's really got a great understanding of, not just being a head coach at Glamorgan, but he's got a great understanding of the Welsh cricketing culture. He really does give back a lot. And so we got all the endorsement and Glamorgan players. Glamorgan had just won the Royal London. So Kieran Carson was a bit of a poster boy. We had Prem Sisodia at Cardiff. He also put his name to it, which is really kind. And amongst us, and then some rugby players. So we got good celebrity, endorsement from the cricketing community. Cricket Wales were supportive. They pushed out videos and things. And this thing grew. So we had five clubs around, I reckon 80 or 90 people ended up walking. Brecon were wonderful, Brecon Cricket Club. They hosted us at the barbecue on the last day, as you know, James. So it's been a wonderful force for good. And on the walk, not only did we sort of stretch ourselves physically, because some of the walking was quite tough, but actually it gave people opportunities to discuss how they run their clubs, what works well for them, what doesn't work so well. And often when we play sport and compete against each other, those conversations between clubs don't take place. And lo and behold, you find out we've all got the same set of problems. We have people on our committees who are good at stuff and others are not so good at stuff at the sort of things we need. So how do we help each other out? There's a loan system in the leagues in the South East Wales League, where clubs can loan each other players. And you find, you know, in communities like the South Wales Valleys, you know, suddenly you'll have a lot of people available for one club and not so much for the other. So why can't they help each other out a little bit? So those conversations on the walk, when you're together for 6 or 8 hours on a walk and a couple of drinks afterwards, you have a fantastic opportunity for those conversations to take place. And they did. And, you know, we were supportive but corrective. You know, we weren't happy about one club's behaviour. In the previous seasons, we had dialogues with them and trust was built. And, you know, lo and behold, they, you know, one of the clubs sort of came in back into the fold, if you like, to be good citizens, good club citizens. And they went on to win the league. So it was a force of good for their club. And actually, they're spearheading, you know, sort of multiracial sport in their club now. You know, they have a lot of halal. You know, they've integrated their South Asian Muslim community into the club. So real force for good. And these were learnings from walking in the valleys. So, you know, and I learned an enormous amount about the fears and aspirations of the people who are brought up in those communities, you know. And if we can help them become stronger and help those communities have cricket at the heart of their communities, I'm absolutely convinced it's a source for good, both socially and from a cricketing perspective, because I know what I went through as a young lad from my background, and I know what good it did for me. Now, it's not for everybody, but I think those communities are a long way down the tracks, those clubs are a long way down the tracks to be able to affect that.
It is, and it's I can share from my perspective. Growing up, I grew up in an area where there's no cricket. I literally grew up on a farm on top of a hill in the middle of mid Wales, where there was no cricket clubs. I had to learn from watching Test match TV. When I played county, like literally for the junior sections and play for the Welsh setup, I had to get a lift from my grandmother, who was in her 70s, to Llandrindol, which was an hour and a half away. Then get picked up to drive another hour down to the south of the county. And the costs, if my grandparents and parents hadn't paid for it, were astronomical. Yeah. So I'm all for you in supporting initiatives, not just in Wales, but across the whole of the UK, for helping people get into the game and supporting them and adding support to these communities who need them. Because you forget how, like I'm in Cardiff, you know, there's a lot of opportunities for you in Cardiff, for example, and other big cities, where you take things for granted.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, British culture has been focused on the metropolitan, not on the small community. There's no doubt about it. These communities are left behind. In fairness to Cricket Wales, they are channeling money into those communities now and very successfully for sporting facilities and doing a good job of that. But I do think that these people come from tougher communities. They produce good rugby players. And you know, to be a top-class cricketer, you have to have a hardiness about you, a resilience about you. And I've no doubt that if those clubs can start to produce younger cricketers, we'll see a much stronger Welsh cricketing community. I think we maybe one day see a Glamorgan team that has got a lot, you know, maybe 8 or 9 Welsh cricketers, which is what they had when they won the championship last in 1997. You know, so I think the size of the prize for supporting the Valleys is enormous if we get it right.
Yeah, I agree. And for me personally, from here, the project we're starting at Cricket Matters, you know, we're fully behind it and we'll definitely report more back on it.
And we've got 9 clubs for this year, James. March and April. We've got 9 clubs.
I know.
It was 5 last year. Maybe we'll end up with 11, which would be wonderful.
I've seen it. And like I said, if we can, whatever we can do to support that initiative, I'll be there. We'll video it to make sure everyone out and the wider audience can listen to that and support as well. Because, yeah, it's about giving back now to the cricketing community on multiple levels.
Thank you, James.
Kenny, it's been absolutely fantastic. Like it's nice to speak to you in a professional manner, in like a very you know, like normal way. We can go back to being ourselves after this little talk now. And I can give you some absolute proper abuse. But no, it's been absolutely fantastic sharing your insight, your stories. You know, and it's fascinating for me to learn some of the stories from back in the days and how things used to go to how you're doing now. So we'll be following your journey, and undoubtedly we'll have you back on the podcast post South Africa and post walking in the valleys too to get that going. Now, is there any where can people find out more about this about the walking in the valleys and the things that you're going up to? Where can we find out more?
So please follow us on Walk in the Valley on our Facebook site, Walk in the Valleys for Young Cricketers. or if you are interested in following the Wales Over 50s and the World Cup, please follow the Wales Over 50s Facebook site. There are primary channels, and the more people who like and support our you know, these movements, the better. So it's all appreciated.
Brilliant. Canny, as we are, you will always be known to me as. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. And for guys, everyone listening in who've enjoyed that show, please make sure you leave a comment, review, share this podcast far and wide to help support any initiatives we're trying to do. And if you've taken something away from this podcast or have any questions for Michael or for myself about this, you know, let us know and we'll answer them on future podcasts or in some other manner and too. So, as we say here in Wales, ciao for now, as they say in Llandaff. It's been absolute pleasure having you on. And until next time, we'll speak to you soon.